I'm Jerry, I'm an addict. And first of all, I want to thank God for allowing me to be here today. I want to thank this convention committee for asking me to come out and share my experience, strength, and hope. I want to thank the pilot and the co-pilot for bringing me from California to Ocean City, Maryland. You know, I want to thank Hampton. I went over his house last night. I want to thank the guy from the Super Shuttle who picked me up at the airport. He let me share my ass off, and he didn't say a word. When I got out the shuttle, he said, thanks for sharing. I want to thank you wherever he at. I want to thank my friends over here. I love y'all so much. I want to thank Tony. I want to thank everybody. Thank God for this fellowship, man. My topic is the gift of desperation. I want you guys for just one moment, just close your eyes. If you ever saw the Wizard of Oz, if you ever saw Dorothy, when she put her feet together like that, you're looking at Jerry B. Because that's what I was. I didn't know I had a disease of addiction. Let me tell you something. I was born in a little town in Ohio in 1953. I was real happy. I played jacks. I played double dutch. I just had fun. I had a real good time. And then something strange happened. 1963, my mother moved me to California with two sisters and an older brother. My father stayed in Ohio. And the next thing I know, I was on my way to the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous because something happened to me. It talks about in the literature that we have fractured personalities. But I need to tell you, man, that my spirit got fractured in 1963. I need to tell you, I grew up looking at Leave It to Goddamn Beaver. It was a two-family household. I need to tell you guys that it was Ward and June. And June would go downstairs and cook breakfast with a fur coat on and pearls around her neck and high heels. And my mother didn't do that, and my father wasn't there. So as a young child, I figured it had to be something wrong with me. I didn't know until I crawled up into the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous and started working the 12 steps of Narcotics Anonymous that it had absolutely nothing to do with me. Sometimes two people aren't supposed to be together. But I carried that with me for a long time. You know, sometimes I hear a lot of people saying, I hate the drugs. Guess what? I'm here to tell you, Ocean City, Maryland, I'm glad the dope was there. Because I would have blew my brains out a long time ago. I didn't know I was so desperate, you guys. I didn't know I hurt so much. My mother did the best she could do with me. But she was not one of us. So when she cared and when she shared, it was not the NA way. And I'm real clear today that my mother only did what she could do. And she did the best that she could do. My mother is 92 years old today. I need to tell you, she is my best friend. If I wasn't married, I would have married my mama. Because she carried me through all this desperation. And I'm reminded of a time some years ago before I got clean that my mother told me. She said, baby, you just running around this world and you're desperate. You're just like a deer. And I was in my active addiction, and you know how we is when we, I don't know how you did it, but I'm going to tell you how I did it. Like, oh, my, I ain't running around like no deer. But I was, because my spirit was broke and I didn't know I had a disease of addiction. And I did a geographic all over the United States and then Canada running from me. And I don't know if anybody else can identify with that shit, man. When you desperate and when you hurting so bad, and you would just do anything to keep from hurting. So you use and you use and you abuse your body and everybody else that you come in contact with. I'm one of these addicts that I grew up in San Francisco. It was nice when I moved there. It was bright lights, big cities, pimps up, hoes down. They had Cadillacs that stretched from San Francisco down to Los Angeles. And so I had came from a Liberty town in Ohio. And when I got there, you know, to San Francisco without my daddy being there and saw all the bright lights in the big city, something happened. And I took off, man. My disease just took off running because I was hurting and I didn't know how to share at my mama's house. Hell, my mama did all the sharing. She's the chairperson, she's the secretary, she's the treasurer. She do the seventh tradition. She do make the coffee, she do it all. So I can remember sitting up on Hippie Hill, you guys, because I was hurting. This was in the early 60s when the hippies came out. And I can remember sitting up there, and I can remember, you know, them passing a bottle around. And I remember this bottle didn't have a name on it, you know, like they do in the stores today, like Thunderbird and 2020 and MD 2020 and all that stuff. It was just like a green bottle. And that's what I vividly remember. And I remember when this bottle got to me, it took away all those feelings. And all of a sudden, I didn't want to play double dutch no goddamn more. I didn't want to play jacks no damn more. I didn't want to do none of that shit. I didn't care about my daddy being in Ohio. I didn't care that my mama brought me out here. I didn't care because my mama wouldn't allow me to share. Everything was okay. And so I used and I used and I used, man. And I did a geographic, I'm telling you, all over the United States. I ended up in Montreal, Canada, and this is my story, and I'm sticking to it, goddammit. I ended up in Montreal, Canada, because I didn't know how desperate I was, but I do know I was doing all these geographics, but my disease told me, oh, girl, you just moving and you're going to do better. So I ended up in a place in Stockton, California, and I met a guy, and he said, guess what? I got a brother that he needs to get his immigration papers, and we'll get somebody $2,500 in Ocean City. Y'all already know what I said. I went straight to Canada and said I do. Still not knowing that I was hurting, you guys. Still not knowing that I was desperate, man. I didn't know how bad this thing was on me. I had two kids. I had kids before Pampers even hit the market. When I had kids, we was washing diapers. At least my mother was. I don't want to come all the way to Maryland and tell you a lie. My mama washed them diapers in the toilet. You know? I used to say I was a good mother. But when I worked the 12 steps in Narcotics Anonymous, I found out I'm a mother on the birth certificate, but I was an absent mother. And my mother took over that role. So in the meantime, let me tell you this. See, I ends up in Montreal, Canada. I'm kicking like a mad Russian. I go through customs and immigration, and I'm sick. And my disease had told me if I got to another country, everything was going to be all right. Now, like I wasn't going to hurt no more. But this same disease told me that if I would leave San Francisco, go to Phoenix, Arizona, which I did, go to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which I did, go to Reno, Nevada, which I did, go to Stockton, California, which I did, all over the world, this disease said, you're going to be okay. I didn't know that there was people just like me. I thought I was the worst person in the world, you guys. I didn't know there was other mothers out there just like me. I didn't know there was fathers like me and that you guys had did the same thing I did. And most of all, I didn't know that we could get clean and that we could find a fellowship in Narcotics Anonymous and work the 12 steps in Narcotics Anonymous and get a God of our understanding. I didn't know any of that. So the meantime, I'm up in Canada, and they sold codeines over the counter. I had a toothache, plus I was kicking like a mad Russian. And I told one of the guys my teeth was hurting, which that was true. There's something about doing the things that I was doing. It just knocks out all your, you know, your teeth. Everything is all messed up. And they went to the store and they brought a bottle of pills for me. And he brought the pills back. And I vividly remember him telling me, just take one, because they're real strong. And when he said the word strong, that is a magic word for addicts. I flipped the bottle over, and I read the ingredients, and it said codeine. And so I said, hello, Canada. So I called my mother back in the United States, and I said, Mom, I'm never coming back to America again. I'm giving up my citizenship. My mother's a very, very spiritual lady. She said, I don't know what the fuck is wrong with you, but you got 5 minutes to bring your ass back home. If nothing changes, nothing changes. You know, a lot of times I share my story, which is my story, and I got some humor to it, but I want the newcomers and the old-timers and the sometimers to identify with me, because I know you've been there, too. So my mother gave me 5 minutes to get back to America. Y'all already know I didn't do that shit. I stayed in Montreal. I did the same thing in another country that I did in our country. If nothing changes, nothing changes. Finally, I had a moment of clarity. And I said, girl, if you don't get up out of here, you're going to be in penitentiary in another country. So I came home. I need to tell you, I'm a BC baby before crack. When I got back, that shit had hit the market. And I said I was never going to do that because I had to put water on mine. And you guys had to be crazy. Now, that's what I said. Yeah. First time I took a hit off the pipe, I didn't know what happened. It was a loved one that gave me my first hit. And you know how they do us. They hold the shit in your mouth and snatch it back. So I'm standing there now. I said, what happened? He said, oh, you got it, girl. Look at your eyes. I said, how can I see my eyes when I'm looking at yours? So I didn't mess with it for a couple of days. I didn't understand the feeling of it. I didn't understand what it was doing to me. But a few days later, I said, I'm just going to get my own. I started smoking that shit. That shit made me lose all the liberty of mind I had left. I used to have hair down in my butt. I start taking a hit off the pipe, and I would break out and run to the grocery store and steal some perm. The first perm they ever came out with, TCB. What you need to know is I would never wash that perm out of my hair. I just put this shit in my hair, and I continue to do the thing that you do. You know what we do. Because I was hurting, and I was hitting it, and I was fanning, and it was hot as hell, and my hair was falling out. You know what? In the meantime, my kids are growing up there, and I'm doing everything because I don't want to feel this shit. I have a daughter that's getting ready to be 37 years old. I need to tell you guys that I shot dope like Congress had wrote a new law when I was pregnant with her. When she was 3 days old, I took her to Mount Zion Hospital in San Francisco on the corner of Divisadero and Sutter. And I told the doctor, I said, I think there's something wrong with my baby. He said, oh, your baby looks fine to me. He counted her fingers, he counted her toes. He said, this baby is fine. I said, you don't understand. Even back then in 1973, I was trying to tell somebody. But I told him, I said, you don't understand. I've been shooting dope on a daily basis. And I was using what I was pregnant with my daughter, and I can remember from 1973 to April the 17th, 2010, how that man looked at me. And I remember getting in touch with some feelings of guilt, some feelings of shame. Because if I hadn't knew anything else, I wouldn't have did it. I remember he took my baby out of my arms, and they tested my baby. And he came back and he told me, he said, your baby's going through withdrawals. And you know what happened next? I had to call my mother and tell her that. And I remember the look in my mother's face. How can you do that to that baby? And all I could tell her was the truth, Ma, I don't know. I don't know. So my mother took over my daughter. She took custody so I wouldn't lose my daughter to the system. And what they told me, they said, we'll let your mom keep her, but you can never, ever, ever use drugs again. This was in 1973. I need to tell you, I crawled up into the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous through the gift of desperation, July the 9th, 1995, and I ain't looked back since. I was in the bathroom, you know, and I was reading my days on here, and I've never really did this in like days, you know. It's like every anniversary, I'm just like, I'm so grateful for every day, but I don't be like counting them. Oh, I got 40 days, I got 77, I got 79, 112. I don't know, I just don't do that because I'm grateful for every day that God gives me. So when I looked down at it and it said the amount of days, I just started crying in the bathroom. I said, God, thank you for the gift of desperation. Thank you for intervening in my life. The last night that I used, you guys, I'm going to tell you this so I can get into this recovery and I want to get into the literature. It was on the 8th of July, 1995. And of all places, I was in a little town, Fresno, California. And they got more dope than they got any damn well. I'm telling you the truth, man. I lost my mind. And I remember a guy knocked on my door. And he came in, and he had a 40-ounce, and he had $60 in his hand. And this was on a Saturday. And it was a day that I had told myself that same old lie. I'm never going to do this no more. I quit. I'm through. I'm finished. That's it. That's the end. That's only because I didn't have nothing else to sell. So when he knocked on my door and he had that in his hand, I remember I pulled this guy in my house so hard. It's a big dude, man. And I was always kind of small. What I didn't tell you, I was born premature. Plus, using didn't help it either. And so I went to the connection's house. And the connection was probably as far as from this end of the wall to this end of the wall. I have no idea that God's getting ready to intervene. I have no idea that what's been happening to me all my life is getting ready to be turned around. I don't know that God has been with me all the way from Ohio to San Francisco to Canada, through Phoenix, Arizona, Denver, Colorado, Reno, Nevada. I don't know God's been with me. But I do know one thing, that I intended to get rid of this man because I had turned out to be real scandalous. I gave that word a household name like Ajax. And I remember running back in my house and I was probably as big as this microphone and I thought I was fine and I should have been on the cover of Ebony magazine. All my hair was broke out. My glasses, the lens were broke out of my glasses. My teeth were all chipped out. I had on a couple of pair of pants. And I still thought I looked good. Hey, if you sitting in here, man, and you in new, this is a powerful disease. This shit will fool you. Even today, almost 15 years later, my disease still go to meetings on a regular basis. My disease still work the 12 steps. My disease still have a sponsor. Hell, my disease is up here sharing that. And it's waiting for me to shut up. So when I run back in my house, you guys, on the 8th of July of 1995, And I was on methadone, and I was on all drugs known to mankind, and I take a hit off the pipe, and I heard a noise. And I couldn't figure out if it was the police kicking the door in, because, you know, I had those Kimbles and Bits. I didn't know what it was, but it was me crying. So when we talk about the gift of desperation, I cried so hard. I don't know if you've ever been in that place, and I believe you have if you're sitting in here today, until snot and boogers start coming up out of my nose. And I cried so hard I was hyperventilating. And the color that I am, I was damn near turning blue. And when I got my breath, I looked at this guy and I said, "You gotta go. I don't know where I'm gonna go. I don't know what I'm gonna do." But it became real clear to me that I didn't want to die. So when he walked out my house, I had this little tray that I had brought my mother up in Canada, that I had all my paraphernalia on. And there was a field in front of my house. It was a fence in the little field. And I threw that tray over the fence. Now, I need to tell you, I'm that same addict that I've thrown away outfits, and I threw pipes over there. And if you guys are a football fan, I'm a 49er. I'm born and bred, and when I'm dead, I'm 49er dead. If you ever seen that game with Joe Montana and Dwight Clark, the catch, before that pipe could hit the ground, I'm working on this because I still think the Niners owe me something because I invented the catch. Because before my shit would hit the ground, I could catch it. I could go up under my legs. I could go backhanded, overhanded. I could do it all kind of ways. But this night, on the 8th of July of 1995, I just let it go. And I shut my door. And I looked at my TV. I had a little TV sitting in the corner on milk crates. And by this time in my disease, I had gotten on SSI and Social Security. They had a plan for people like us. They said if you were a dope fiend, they would give you a check, which sounded pretty good to me. Part of my active addiction, I kept a job because I never could hustle. Every time I stole something, it was like a Monopoly game. I didn't go to county jail, I went straight to the penitentiary. So I kept a job in hotels and motels because welfare was not enough money for me to do the things I wanted to do. I went and applied for Social Security. They denied me the first time. So I went back to work because I had to get my hustle on, right? Then I did a recertification, and my late sister called me at the hotel, and she said, "Girl, you just got approved." And y'all already know Ocean City. I went right downstairs and quit the damn job. Shit, I'm out. I gotta go. I gotta go back to Ohio. The whole state then blew up. I gotta, just anything. Because part of my disease is lying, man. So I got on SSI and Social Security, and my mother became my payee. And my mother is a wonderful payee. I need to tell you, if something happened to y'all, don't never ask her to be your payee. She do everything that we don't do. She pay your rent. She pay PG&E, which is the gas and electric. She do all that stuff. She even got the nerve to buy you food. You ever seen a dope fiend eat? So I had this little TV on milk crates, and I also had cable because my mother had got that for me. And on the cable box, it said 11:27 p.m. And I didn't understand that night, but I do understand this day that the God of my understanding wanted me to know that I had been blessed with the gift of desperation, and I never, ever, ever, ever had to put nothing in my body again. That next morning, I crawled up into the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous. My first meeting was in Fresno, California, on the corner of Fresno and Barstow. The name of that meeting is Sicker Than Most. If you're ever in town, I'll give you some numbers. We'd love to have you there. And I crawled up in the air, and I sat at the back door. and I was big as this thing right here, but I thought I was looking good. And I had on that cheap Wet n Wild mascara, the 99 cent. But what happened to me was I got a shot of hope in that meeting. I heard addicts saying that they were staying clean and they had did the same thing and they had felt the same way and they had been desperate just like me. And so I stayed in the meeting. At the end of the meeting, they asked if anybody had a burning desire. And of course, I was fresh from the streets. I didn't know what our logos and slogans were around here. I thought y'all was gonna toss one up there. So I jumped up like Jack in the Box. And I said, my name is Jerry. I didn't know if I was an addict or alcoholic or a man or a woman, but I knew. And I knew and I knew that you knew that I knew that I needed some help. I said, please help me. I don't want to die. I need to tell you that the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous embraced me. And you guys told me, you said, girl, we're going to love you until you can love yourself. You guys told me to go to meetings, go to 90 meetings. I said, and then what? You said, keep going, you go to 91. You guys told me to get a sponsor. I said, what the hell is a sponsor? You guys told me to get the IPs, to get phone numbers. So I did all that, man. I did all that. Everything you guys said, I did. I got in the service. My first commitment was a coffee maker. Here it is, almost 15 years later, I don't make good coffee. You drink my coffee, you might not never go to sleep. So that's just the way the beginning of my journey was for me, man. You know, so I got a sponsor, and I went to meetings for a whole year. I didn't try to go back to work or anything. And then when I went back to work, I went back into the hotel industry. And I became an assistant general manager, and I'm talking about the grace of a loving God. I'm not talking about Jerry B. Because when I was using, every one of my dealers had white sheets and white towels and comforters. So God had a way of showing me how to make some amends. And I went back into the hospitality industry. And I opened up hotels in every city and state and country that I've ever did a geographic in. You tell me God ain't good. In February of 2004, I was on the peninsula. That's in Northern California. It's right in between Redwood City, if anybody knows anything about California. I had opened up a hotel, and I got sick, you guys. And I thought maybe I had a really bad cold. So I told my general manager, I said, I'm going to go to my house. I'm going to take something for this cold, you know, and you can page me. But when I got in my car, I heard this voice. And this voice told me, just keep driving. Just keep going, baby. I got the wheel. So I drove right past my house. I went to the hospital in Redwood City. I asked them if they would test me for HIV. They looked at me like I was crazy. I had 8.5 years clean. I walked up in there with a suit and a towel. And they looked at me like I was crazy. I said, but you don't understand. Here's my experience again, man. I said, you don't understand. I used to shoot dope. And I never bothered with the clean needle exchange. If I was sick and you had what I wanted, then it was on and it was cracking for real, for real. And even though I said I wouldn't turn no tricks when I worked the 12 steps in Narcotics Anonymous and you had what I wanted, we did the do that you know that we do. So they took the test and they came back and they told me that I had went way past HIV. He said, you have full-blown AIDS. And he said, you're gonna die. But guess how God showed up and showed out. I need to tell you today, Ocean City, that my T-cells is over 900, that the viral load is undetectable in my body, that I take one pill a night, Thank God for the gift of desperation. While I was still laying in a hospital, I got a call from a convention committee asking me to be a main speaker. God had already showed up and showed out. I told him I'd be there. I got out the hospital. I worked the first step around having that disease. If you are new, if something happens to you, you work the first step. I had to do it. I had to get into acceptance. I had to surrender that. I had to give it to the God of my understanding. I couldn't hold myself responsible for over 30 years of active addiction. I'm a human being. I had to forgive myself. I went on and spoke at that convention. I went on to open up 3 more hotels. I retired from that in 2005. And now I'm working with people just like us because I want to be able to give back. So now what I need to tell you, those 2 daughters that I had, the one that I used with, is going to be 37 years old in August. My oldest daughter is going to be 40 next year in January. I have 3 wonderful grandkids. God has really blessed me. Thank God for the gift of desperation. I'm married to a wonderful husband. He would have been here today, but we had a flood in our house in California. Plus, he started a new job. So I had to come to give a message to the newcomer to let you know, no matter what, an addict, any addict, I don't care what color you are. I don't care what color your hair is. I don't care if you got 2 legs, 3 legs, no legs. That you don't have to use no matter what. No matter what the doctors say. No matter what the police say. No matter what the judges say. No matter what your mama and them said. No matter if your daddy didn't say it. You don't have to use no matter what. For me, Narcotics Anonymous is one-stop shop. We got a first step that is second to none all over the world. And that's all you got to do is work the steps in Narcotics Anonymous. Learn how to love you. I had to learn how to love me. I had to get down on my knees and forgive myself. I thoroughly worked these steps. I got some freedom in my life today. I still got a disease, but you know what? I'm not as desperate as I was in 1995. God has been truly good to me, you guys. I'm truly a miracle. And you are sitting in here tonight. And I don't know your story, but I do know your story. And maybe we weren't on the same corners or did the same thing. But if you're sitting in here, just know that the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous, we are everywhere. We are all over the world. And you never, ever, ever, ever have to use again. Ocean City, my name is Jerry B. I want to thank you for allowing me to share. I want to tell you. Today, April the 17th, 2010, that I'm doing more living than surviving. Thank you.
I'm an addict. My name is Greg. And I get to say the same thing again. If you talk to an addict long enough, you'll find out you connected. We have another Jerry. Jerry S. from Pittsburgh.
My name is Jerry, and I'm an addict. I want to thank God for touching the hearts of those. I want to thank God for touching the hearts of those who find me worthy of speaking at a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. My topic, the gift of desperation. I want to thank Jerry for sharing, setting the tone for this topic. I'm going to share a little bit about my experience, my strength and hope. I relate it to so many things. I need to talk about how that desperation manifested itself in my life. In our literature, in the introduction, it starts off by saying that based on our experience, we believe that every addict, including the potential addict, suffers from an incurable disease of body, mind, and spirit. That made me think of what was going on with me before I picked up this drug. It made me think about this topic that we had about desperation. And even though I didn't know anything about the disease of addiction, I could relate to the dis-ease. I could relate to the discomfort. I could relate to something that was missing that we call this void. I remember coming up with in a place called Manchester down in the Pittsburgh area. That dis-ease just kind of triggered these little beginnings and the starts of these little desperations. I think we say in the program of Narcotics Anonymous that we know we needed something different. We know we needed something different. I can always remember feeling that dis-ease or feeling that the fact that I wasn't whole and that I wasn't complete. I always did that comparison kind of thing. I thought that everybody had just a little bit of edge on me. It was always this little transparent glass that separated me from you. You was always just a little bit better than me, and I couldn't figure out what it was that I needed to feel whole. Mm-hmm. Always feeling dis-ease or always feeling discomforted. And I want to talk about that most obvious symptom of this disease, that drug. Because it took me a while, and I'm the one of them people that thought that they had found it in drugs. I was one of those guys. This neighborhood that I grew up in, it seemed like everybody was poor. Father was alcoholic, didn't understand much about alcoholism. Always wanted a nice house. Always wanted to be like the guys down the street where their families ate together. And they seemed to be going to church on Sundays and they had the car and all that kind of stuff. I told myself I want to have a house like my uncle's house because my uncle's house in Cleveland didn't have roaches. I'm talking about starting off real early on from a place of beginning with a dis-ease to becoming desperate. I remember planning the attack on roaches. I remember leaving the house and telling myself, when I come back, I'm gonna get them. I We used to have them old-fashioned spray cans with the big old barrel on the bottom. It was like a machine gun. And when I would walk in the house and cut the lights on, I would attack them. Coming to be desperate. I just wanted some things that it appeared like other people had, because y'all were such good actors. I learned in this program when they told me, they say, Jerry, don't judge your insides against everybody else's outsides. And I was thinking that y'all all had it together, and I was the only one that didn't have these things. And when I started using this chemical, someone told me that addiction was an innocent search for wholeness. That it was an innocent search for wholeness, because the drug appeared to do something to me. It seems to fill up that void or that thing that was inside of me. I should have left the void alone. Because I found out later on in recovery that that void has substance. And it's just God's way of nudging me and letting me know that I need to do something spiritual. This disease that I have that started and predated my drug use, manifested itself on my outsides. And what it looked like when I came to rooms of Narcotics Anonymous, it looked like a buck 17. It looked like blood in my shoes and blood in my shoestrings. It looked like blood in my pants. It looked like tracks down this arm and tracks down this arm and tracks in this hands. It looked like my face all broke out looking like pizza. It looked like a matted afro. That disease that I had on the inside, the dis-ease, the discomfort, manifested itself into a physical thing. You have had to have seen me. And I'm talking about desperation. I'm talking about taking the needle and shooting the needle of dope in my mother's house and telling myself, I just don't want to die in my mother's house. And I would take off and run down the street, and people would look at me with the needle hanging off my arm. And this is people that babysitted me. But so desperate that something inside of me was saying, don't take the needle out just in case you survive. And when I feel myself mellowing out, I would turn back around and walk toward the house and just look at my neighbors. I'm talking about that type of desperation. I'm talking about that type of despair. That type of despair and desperation that something in me was telling me, Jerry, something bad is going to happen to you. I don't know what it is, man, but something bad is going to happen to you. And that's the way I walked my life for the last 15 years of my addiction. In total fear, desperation. I wasn't one of those type of drug users that had a glamorous drug life. I was a $5, $10, $20 hustler. Every now and then I get a couple extra dollars. But it was a job for me. It was a job. It talks about in our readings about only in desperation did we ask ourselves, could it be the drugs? It talks about some of the highs felt great, but eventually the things that we had to do, continued using, reflected desperation. And then it gets to this thing called, why are we here? There was nothing that I did that was so clever that got me into the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous. I know today that the only thing that got me here was God's grace and mercy. That God knew a long time ago that me and you would need a place to go. And that he put into the minds and the hearts of people to come up with a program for peculiar people like us. That he loved us long before we felt the love in the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous. It talks about in our readings that we sought, we continued to progress until in desperation we sought help from each other. From each other is important for me. I remember coming to rooms of Narcotics Anonymous. No design of my own. I come to get my note signed. I come because the PO told me you had to go get some note signed. And when I got here, there were some things that was going on, but I just didn't know what. I didn't know if you were smiling because you was happy, or was you continually faking the funk. I start seeing people get key tags. 30 days, 60 days, 90 days. I start seeing these readings. I start hearing people share. And I read something in the literature where it said that this is an atmosphere about empathy. About empathy. About feeling somebody's feelings as if they were your own. And I started to identify, and people started identifying with me. I didn't know that the gift of desperation was the ability that people who were desperate to identify with mine. They were here waiting for me. They could identify with the desperation that I had. Their desperation became my gift. They could identify with everything that I was saying. This is what we do in here in Narcotics Anonymous. In the 12th step, it says, our empathy isn't abstract, nor is our understanding. Instead, it is born in a shared experience. It says that we greet each other with the recognition reserved for the survivors of a near-fatal catastrophe. What does that mean to me? That means that when I got here, you had a greeting that was reserved especially for me. That it was a greeting reserved for a person who has survived a near fatal catastrophe. That was me. This is how I look at it. I remember reading this right around the time it was that tsunami. And it was this guy who was standing on the edge of the riverbank, and the floods were coming all the way down the water, and he had his wife by the hand, and he had his two kids in the other hand wrapped around a tree. And he knew that he couldn't hold his wife and the kids at the same time. And his wife said, let me go. She said, let me go because you can't save the kids and save me too. And he let his wife go. often think that when those people went to that Superdome, I often think of what type of greeting would he have for her if she survived? I said, what kind of greeting would he have if he thought she had died from a fatal catastrophe? And she showed up at the door. What type of intense greeting would he have for her? And I'm saying that's the type of attitude that we should have when the newcomer comes into the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous. Because I understand being in a near fatal catastrophe. I remember dying 2, 3, 4 times on an overdose. I remember being in the emergency room and being on the floor where they tell me, I don't expect you to make it. I remember overdosing, laying on the floor outside the YMCA, and the ambulances around me asking me stupid-ass questions. What day is it? Who's the president? Yeah, that's right. And all those type of things. Survivors of a near fatal catastrophe. The type of hug that you give me lets me know that you understand, that you have empathy. It says that empathy is not abstract, it's a greeting that's reserved of a person who had a near fatal catastrophe. That's me. The other gift is me. I become the gift to that person that's walking in here with desperation. It's because I identify. I identify. I heard Jerry start off by saying, close your eyes. And when I close my eyes, I remember the desperation that I had to have that drug at all costs. I remember being desperate where I'm taking my mama stuff. I remember being desperate where I'm taking my kids' stuff. I remember being desperate where I'm taking my father's stuff. The gift of recovery is what we receive in here. I remember my sponsor. This was a guy that I got high with probably for like 10 or 15 years. And I remember him looking different and just being a little bit different. Couldn't put my hand on it. I remember still trying to go to him and hustle and get money and everything off of him, and him telling me things like, either I'm part of the problem or I'm part of the solution. I refused to be a part of the problem. That man eventually ended up being my sponsor. I would see him come and I would see him go. And at this point of my life, I never knew anybody that was coming around on the set that didn't get high. We used to say we was clean if we switched chemicals. And he would just walk by and I would see something different. He had already received the gift. He had already received the gift of recovery. My spiritual insides is better than it was. When people see me today, they don't see the same spiritual dis-ease that they saw 23 years ago.
That's right. That's right.
They don't see the same person. When I describe to some people what it was like for me, sometimes for them, it's hard for them to believe it. That dis-ease has starting to been healed today. What everyone in the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous turned out to be for me was healers. They healed me through the hugs that they gave me. They healed me through the messages that I received in discussions, the sponsorship, the step work. I'm not as desperate. I thank God on a regular basis that He touched who He touched to bring this message of Narcotics Anonymous to us. It also says in our readings that helping others is perhaps the highest aspiration of the human heart. I'm talking about the empathy that's not abstract. I'm talking about when I'm in those perfect moments, when it's me and another recovering addict, and I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that I ain't supposed to be no other place than in that moment. When something happens, when some magic happens, when we have the ability and the capacity to be in somebody's life and feel and know that God has used you to make a difference. That for that moment, that desperation is gone, and the person lets you know, they say, thanks. I had the honor of being near Pittsburgh last week. And there were several speakers there, and they filled me up. When I was new, and on this journey of recovery, people have always been there for me. And I would be intimidated. And I would be afraid because of somebody's time or their delivery and all that kind of stuff. And I'm at a place in my life right now where I'm with the newcomer almost every day. And I relate on a level to the newcomer that is consistent to how people related to me. With empathy. With understanding. But something happened when I was at this speaker jam. I had 23 years with newcomer's feelings. I felt intimidated. I've been so busy giving that it felt uncomfortable to get. Very uncomfortable. And I felt myself wanting to isolate. And people was taking my telephone number and I was taking theirs and they was calling me and I felt that dis-ease again. I felt that dis-ease. I felt it like I was when I was younger. No, he better than me. She better than me. I couldn't connect with the empathy. That's why we up here all the time, we talk about, can you feel me? People say it all the time. Can you feel me? Can you identify with what I'm feeling? Because we know this is a feeling disease. I don't know how to look at you in the eye as an equal. I got to act better than or feel less than. I don't know how to be equal. I don't know how to connect. So I started having them newcomer feelings and these guys was calling me. Phone would ring, I'd be like, oh shit. What they gonna say? I think they know I feel this way. Come on, Chief. That's why I think you know I feel this way. If you see me, some lady said today, smile. Remember? I didn't even know I was looking all like that. I think I was more afraid, and it showed on my face as something else. Because I was still feeling that discomfort and that dis-ease. So I needed to hear different people share to get reconnected, to know that you and me are the same, that it's only one love, it's only one consciousness, it's only one disease, but my disease is always about separation. That's why it's important that when we come in here as newcomers and old comers and all that kind of stuff, that we get that hug, that we listen, that we identify, that we empathize, and so we can reconnect. Because my disease has always been about disconnection. Always about disconnection. He's better than me because he's bigger than me. He's better than me because he's richer than me. And once I started filling the room, and I was talking to a brother right before I come in here, right before I got ready to close, he was talking about how we, those weapons of mass destruction. He didn't use that word, but that's the word I heard. The weapons of mass destruction, the ones like alienation, and not knowing how to open up, in defensiveness, and not knowing how it talks about it in the basic text, just let the spirit flow, the flow of love flow, being inhibited. And what I heard him say, but he didn't say it. He said, but there is an ultimate weapon.
That's right. Ultimate.
That's bigger and better than the weapons of mass destruction that reside in my dis-ease. It's another recovering addict. It's the highest power that works through that recovering addict that pays a personal visit to you each time I say, I love you, and you can feel me. It's God showing up paying a personal visit to us. That's how much God loves us. If you can't get it no other kind of way, he say, then it's you that's going to have to get to know me via addiction. You're going to have to get to know me via addiction. That's the route you got to take. Because I'm going to send the ultimate weapon that knows how to be transparent, that will let me work through him or her and love you. That's the way I'm going to show up in your life. It might be something as simple as a hug. It might be something simple as a glance. It might be something as simple as, here's $5. It might be something as simple as, come on, let's go to a meeting. It might be something as simple as, come on, let's work the steps. Let's get something to eat. That's how God shows up. Through the ultimate weapon. And when we have people here that work the steps, we know how to get out the way to let God work through us. When a new person walks in the door, be a part of their healing process. Help take away the desperation. I'm going to close with this. When I got to the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous, I did not know where I was going. It's just that God had arranged things in a certain kind of way that I stumbled in the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous. It wasn't a conscious decision. And even though I didn't know where I was going, I had a general feeling I was in the right place. It was just a general feeling that I was in the right place. I would sit over on the side. And I stuck around here long enough that I start seeing miracles in other people's lives. I start seeing the obsession to use removed from my life. I saw miracles in people's lives like getting a driver's license. People's complexion coming back. People picking up weight. Getting their hair done. Getting haircuts. Getting a new pair of sneakers. I'm talking about miracles. I seen mothers become mothers again, and fathers become fathers again, and sons become sons again. I seen friends become friends again. I've seen miracles happen in the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous. And each one of us is that gift. Don't pass up the opportunity to be somebody's gift. Because I'm always thinking less of myself. Until God puts us in a situation with another recovering addict, and they tell you something like, "Thanks, man. You impacted me. You made a difference in my life." The gift of desperation is recovery. The gift of desperation is the empathy that we feel because we can relate to all the desperation. People need to know that. We need to give it the way it was given. Again, I want to thank everybody for being so patient. I want to thank, CPR? Because that's exactly what it is. It's definitely CPR. And if there's someone that's new, they just asked us to do some simple suggestions. They said, don't pick up nothing a day at a time. Do 90 meetings in 90 days, get a sponsor, get a home group. Read the literature, do the step work, learn how to pray. My name is Jerry. Thanks for letting me share.